Enderet, representing Mr. Davis.
Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices of the Supreme Court. My name is Rex Andrew, and I represent the appellant, defendant appellant David Leibnitz in this case. Before I get started, I'd like to say it's an honor and a privilege to appear before you this morning. There are several issues before the court today, the primary of which is whether or not Mr. Leibnitz admitted his repeat offender status in the context of these proceedings. There are other issues related to judicial estoppel, waiver, and invited error. And I think the logical way to conceptualize and approach this case is to first examine the question of whether or not it can be said that Mr. Leibnitz admitted his prior repeat offender status on this record, and because I conclude that he did not, then turn to the question of whether he is somehow barred by any of those doctrines from contesting that he didn't. Was there an admission on this record? The logical point of departure would be this court's decision in Rockwell. While Rockwell acknowledged the rule set forth in State v. Farr that there must be a direct and specific admission to prior convictions, it also ruled that a defendant didn't necessarily have to expressly admit a specific conviction if a direct and specific admission would flow from the plea process. Like the present case, the criminal complaint in Rockwell contained a repeater provision. I read Rockwell and his progeny as holding that a presence of a repeater provision is in the complaint is a critical component of an implied admission case such as this one. But I also read Rockwell as holding that the mere presence of a repeater provision is not enough. Something more is required than the plea colloquy. Something where we can look at the record and say, even if the defendant never expressly admitted a prior conviction, he expressly understood that he was facing enhanced penalties because of his repeat offender status. Somewhere where he expressly acknowledges that there is a link between his repeat offender status and the enhanced penalties. I believe this is what persuaded this court in Rockwell, because the record in Rockwell contained an exchange between the trial court and the defendant where it was crystal clear that the defendant understood this link. And the Rockwell opinion was rife with language that the plea colloquy is a critical component in producing a direct and specific admission. So how does this case look when examined under the Rockwell template? I believe it falls way short in establishing a direct and specific admission because not once during the exchange between the trial court and the defendant was the alleged repeater status ever mentioned.
Counsel?
Yes.
I agree it never was mentioned. Obviously, they couldn't have agreed on this plea unless the repeater enhancement applied. And it just strikes me that we ought to get down to the bottom line. And the bottom line is your client thinks he should get 9 years instead of 15, right?
That's correct.
And you're going to rely on 973.13 that this is an excessive sentence.
That's correct.
Well, why can't we just send this back for resentencing? And at that time, he can either say that these repeaters are not correct, but they are correct. I mean, the reason that I think you're here is because you're relying on 973.13.
Well, I think that that's a good, very good question that I hadn't considered that option, and I would have to admit that I'm not prepared to respond to that today. Only that I would say that this proceeding had reached a finality, and the defendant was sentenced. And I guess if I were to look at that issue, I might want to consider whether there might be some double jeopardy concerns with that. But I'm not.
Well, you brought up this issue, so I don't know that you haven't waived any double jeopardy. I haven't considered that, but I'm very happy to think about that. But, you know, we're fooling around with, did he say it? Did he say it good enough? Maybe. We had the Burns case last, May or June, where he didn't say, I plead guilty, but he came. I wrote for the court. He came close enough, and he fell over the line. But it seems to me we've got to look at the bottom line here. And then that'll get rid of a lot of the cases. which I'm just fooling around with, pardon the expression, technicalities, statutory technicalities, not constitutional technicalities.
I guess my only other response to that would be there was a proceeding at which the state had an opportunity to carry out its burden of proving the prior conviction status and or eliciting an admission, and it failed to do so, and that proceeding is now complete.
That goes back to your waiver argument.
Yes.
Okay. I made my point, and I don't know any more about it.
Thank you, Justice.
Don't drive it, but that's okay.
Continuing, I would state that not only was the alleged repeater status never mentioned during the colloquy, nor not once was alleged prior convictions ever mentioned, and in fact, the maximum penalties, it was not mentioned that the maximum penalties that he was facing were enhanced penalties. And if you look at the transcript of the colloquy, the defendant wasn't even advised, at least by the court, of the maximum penalties that he was in fact facing, although they are set forth in the plea questionnaire.
Counsel, can't we infer that he understands the potential punishment, maximum potential punishment?
I think we can infer that he understands the maximum potential punishment because that is set forth in the plea questionnaire, which we know that he signed. What we can't infer is that he understood that maximum potential punishment came about as a result of the repeat offender allegation. That can't be inferred on this record. The plea questionnaire and waiver of rights forms cannot be said to have cured any shortcomings of the colloquy because that document also does not contain any mention of prior convictions, repeat offender status, or enhanced penalties.
Is it your position, in fact, counsel, that he did not understand the repeater implications of this case?
It's my position that it is impossible to tell on this record whether he did or he didn't.
But at the hearing on the complaint, or I guess it was the bail hearing, the court advised him that by virtue of your repeater status, the above penalty is enhanced or increased by 6 years. Mr. Leibowitz responded in the affirmative, and he understood that.
He was told that, I believe, 3 or 4 days following the accident, but obviously was sort of a terrible accident where he himself was hurt. And he was still, I would think, at that point in time, somewhat in the shock of being arrested and finding himself in the situation that he was in. Yes, he was told that at that time. That is correct. But to say 6 months later that he had this in mind when he entered a plea is not apparent on the record, given the fact that nobody brought this to his attention at that point in time.
Counsel,
yes.
So you're saying that when he says he was aware, and the answer was yes to the question of the repeater status, what you're saying he really wasn't, so his answer is disingenuous or wrong? What I'm not sure is what you're relating to is 4 days after the accident he was told this, and now it's 6 months later. What I think Justice Babbitt is asking is that when the judge asked him, and he said, yes, I am, What are you trying to equate? That's what I'm asking.
I see. And I'm sorry if I misunderstood the question. It's what did he mean when he said, at the time of the plea,
yes,
I'm aware of the criminal complaint? You can use the criminal complaint as a factual basis for the plea. I guess what I would say in response to that issue is that at the time that a person is entering a plea, the whole immediacy of their situation relates to the present charges. They've been arrested because of the present charges. They are incarcerated because of the present charges. They're coming to court and they're entering a plea on the present charges and they're going to be sentenced on the present charges. And when you read the plea colloquy, all that is mentioned are the present charges. So when the court asks the defendant, do you contest the allegations in the criminal complaint, or can we rely on that as a factual basis? I think it's logical to assume that a person at that time who says yes would be saying yes in the context of the present charges, since that's all that's being addressed at that point in time. And I think to infer that the defendant is admitting a prior conviction, which was read to him nearly 6 months earlier and shortly following this incident, would be a stretch. That would be my position on that issue.
Well, if it's a position, counsel, that he didn't understand what he was doing when he entered this plea, and that we cannot tell from the record whether or not he understood what he was doing, at least insofar as the repeater aspect of this case is concerned, when he entered his plea, isn't the remedy for that a motion to withdraw the plea and start all over? And if the answer to that question is yes, which I think it is, then why didn't he do that in this case rather than just ask for the sentence adjustment?
Well, because the route that we chose was taken because there's a body of case law that's out there that says when a defendant, and there's a statute out there that says when there's a sentence imposed in excess, then the excess is void. So
as a practical matter, he doesn't want to withdraw his plea because as a practical matter, he knew very well what he was doing. And he knew of the repeater implications, and he certainly knew what his prior record was. And there's no dispute about what his prior record was. And he wants the benefit of the plea bargain to remain intact. He doesn't want to unravel this whole thing. He just wants a sentence adjustment on the basis of the technical failure of the record to reflect the fact that nobody made him say, "I admit I am a repeater."
As a practical matter, you're correct. He does not want to withdraw his plea to this case because he is admitting his guilt of the crimes for which he was charged. It wouldn't make sense for him to withdraw the plea because he was guilty of the counts for which he was charged. And because the statute exists that says that the excess is void, I guess he does want the benefit of the plea, but that's really not the issue at this point. He's not really here saying, the primary issue is we're not saying that his sentence should be modified from 15 to 9 years. What we're saying is, that's a result that's compelled by statute. What we're saying is that the state had the burden to either prove his prior conviction or to make sure that an admission was elicited, and because it did not, the remedy that is required by statute is one that is required by statute that the sentence be changed to 9 years. So, yeah, obviously he's attempting to take the full benefit of the law that exists.
That's 973.13,
right?
973.13,
maybe?
973.13, sorry.
Yes.
So whether or not this plea was knowing and voluntary and the whole body of case law subsequent to Bangert really has no application here whatsoever?
I don't think so. We're not claiming that the plea was not knowing and voluntary. We're simply claiming that the state had an obligation to prove the conviction or elicit an admission, and it failed to do so. And so we can't say on this record that he admitted and hand
in your argument.
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the end of your sentence. I'm sorry.
You can't say on this record that he admitted a repeat offender status.
And your argument, of course, is that any totality of the circumstances argument of the state is would be insufficient because it's either black or white. In other words, there is a bright line here. Your client either had to, on the record, have this colloquy, or the state had to prove its case, period.
That's correct. And I don't think it's that difficult of a burden either. The state could either present a certified copy of the conviction, which in this case was allegedly in the same county. It could also ask the court to elicit a specific admission, or in light of Rockwell, it could simply ensure that a plea colloquy is conducted in such a way.
And I shouldn't say, the idea of sandbagging comes to mind. You can sit back in a case similar to this and say, well, I understand everything, but ultimately I want to, as Justice Sykes indicated, come up and make a 973 argument here, 973.13 argument. There's something about that just seems to be a little, I won't say disingenuous, but it seems less than sympathetic.
I understand your justice's concerns, and I think that there is that sort of flavor to this case that is simply unavoidable. But I think rather than terming it sandbagging, it's really not the defendant's job to come in and make sure that his prior convictions are elicited and put on the record. That's the state's job.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really where fault primarily lies, is in the state's failure to do that.
And they've got the burden of proof.
Yes.
Mr. Andrick, just looking at the plea questionnaire, it's entitled Request to Enter Plea and Waiver of Rights. Paragraph 11 of that document indicates, I am aware of the possible maximum penalties that may be imposed by the court upon my conviction of this charge, which in this case are, and then he says as count 1, 2, and 3, equal 8 years each. How can you claim, looking at that document, which apparently was signed by your client, bears a signature, how can you say he wasn't aware at the time he's entering the plea of the possible maximum penalties, which of course are the maximum because of the enhancer?
Well, I think that we can't maintain that the defendant was not aware of the possible maximum penalties. I think that's apparent by the document that he...
I think so, too. And I understood you to say earlier that no one told him he wasn't aware of the maximum penalties, that had happened 6 months before at the bail hearing or at the initial appearance on the complaint. Obviously, he had a conversation just before he entered his plea.
Yeah, I think what I said, and maybe what you're referring to, is that during the actual plea colloquy itself, the court did not advise the defendant, are you aware that the maximum penalties that you're facing are X number of years, although certainly it is in the plea colloquy. But a defendant, I mean, it's certainly possible that a defendant could become aware of the maximum penalties that he or she is facing and not necessarily understand that those maximum penalties have come about as a result of repeat offender status.
Well, how do you get around the transcript at the time of the entry of the plea and then on to sentencing? And I'm looking at page 11 of the transcript. Mr. Thornton, Judge, I'd also ask the court to find as a matter of law the repeater allegation in the complaint. The court will find that he apparently is a repeater as defined under Wisconsin statutes. Your client was sitting there, his lawyer was sitting there, nobody objected. Isn't this an admission, or at least a constructive admission?
Well, I think, first of all, that I would point out that it is very interesting that the trial court stated the court will find that the defendant is, quote, apparently, close quote, a repeat offender. And I think that comment apparently speaks volumes about certainty with which this was established in this hearing.
Well, don't you think maybe the judge was waiting to hear whether or not the defendant or the defendant's counsel objected to those allegations?
Well, I don't know what was in the court's mind, but I think if that was the approach that it was taking, that would not be a very good way of conducting a plea colloquy. But to get back to your question about the defendant's silence, the defendant's silence in that particular situation could mean a lot of things. I mean, it could mean that he's not sure of his repeat offender status, he doesn't want to rock the boat. It could mean that he thinks that he may not be a repeat offender, but is sort of muted by the solemnity of the proceedings. And it could mean any number of things, and I think that if we allow silence to be construed as an admission, silence is not supposed to be inferred by statute. I think that was this court's pronouncement in, I believe it was McAllister, but I can't be certain. Silence should not be inferred, an admission should not be by statute be inferred. And I think also the danger of allowing silence to be construed as an admission is that in effect you are kind of shifting the burden to the defendant speak up and establish whether or not he is a repeat offender. And we don't do that. I mean, the burden remains with the state. And so I think that it would be a dangerous precedent to allow the fact that the defendant didn't object to something or didn't speak up and say something to be a construed as a direct and specific admission, which is required.
But there's more than silence here, isn't there, counsel? I mean, the silence you were referring to occurred only at 3 years, because the hearing for the bail included six separate times that the judge told him that he was subject to repeater and enhanced penalty. Six different times Mr. Leibitz responded that he was aware of it. And the information also contained. Then there's the document Justice Crook referred to. Are you saying we must ignore all of that?
I'm not saying that we have to ignore all that, but I think that you really ought to focus. And I think, as a matter of public policy, we ought to focus on what occurs at the time of the sentencing and at the time of the plea and sentencing. And what is done at that particular proceeding to establish an admission. We know there were allegations that the defendant was a repeat offender that were made in the criminal complaint. And we know on this record that the defendant was made aware of those. In late August when he first appeared before the court. But certainly there's nothing in that transcript wherein the defendant is admitting that he's a repeat offender when those allegations are first made. He's just acknowledging that he's being told that. And then we fast forward 6 months and we have this whole plea hearing where there's just nothing there regarding those repeat offender allegations. And all I'm saying is that there needs to be something done at that hearing, or in the context of that hearing, or in the context of the plea agreement, to establish that the defendant is aware of this, so that when he enters a plea, we can say, yes, a direct and specific admission flows from this plea, as was said in Rockwell.
Could I ask you, counsel, are you familiar with this court's recent decision in State versus Burns?
Yes.
How would you distinguish this case from State versus Burns?
Well, I read that case and didn't really believe that it had any direct application. My understanding in that case was the court held that a plea could be taken and would not be reopened even if the defendant did not actually say no contest or guilty, and the court went back and looked at the context of the proceedings and made it and said that in the context of those proceedings it was amply clear that the defendant intended to enter a plea. I don't know that if we can look at the context of these proceedings. I mean, in that case there was a statement in the plea questionnaire, I intend to enter a not guilty or a no contest plea. There's nothing in this plea questionnaire or in the plea agreement that says I admit that I'm a repeat offender. So I guess I would distinguish it on that basis, that factually in the Burns case there was plenty of other indicia which would allow the court to make that inference. In fact, the court stated, there was, even the defendant admitted there was nothing else that could be construed that he intended to do that day. But I don't think that the same other indicia of reliability are here in this case.
Mr. Andrick, what's the reason behind the requirement in 973.12 for either proof by certified judgment of conviction of the priors or an admission from the defendant?
Well, I would presume that the reason behind that is that we don't want defendants who are not really repeat offenders to be repeat offender sentences, so we have these safeguards in place to make sure that doesn't happen.
I think so, too. But in this case, there's no dispute that he was a repeat offender.
That's not a dispute that's raised on appeal.
Well, it's not a dispute as a matter of fact, either, is it?
It is not a dispute as a matter of fact. My personal knowledge on this issue is, and I'm being honest, quite frankly, I don't know. But he has never told me, hey, that particular allegation in the complaint is wrong. So okay. I assume
Waring Fink would never have pleaded out his client to a repeater offense if it was not a repeater offense, right?
I don't think Waring would have done that.
Right. So that's just a non-issue here. He was a repeater. Everybody knows he's a repeater. Everybody in that courtroom at the time knew he was a repeater. It's just the judge didn't make him say it, right?
I believe that's correct. But the issue here is much larger than Mr. Leibniz's case. The court's decision is not going to affect just Mr. Leibniz. It's a matter of public policy. And certainly it is possible that with the plea colloquy and the way this case was handled, that a person could slip through the cracks, that a person could not be a repeat offender and yet be sentenced as a repeat offender.
Well, then wouldn't the proper thing, you'd come to the court and the court would look at that on the basis of the totality argument made by the state and make a different decision.
But I don't think we should be in the business of adopting a policy which will allow an error to occur simply because there's a mechanism in place to come back and correct it. We should adopt a policy which doesn't allow the error to occur in the first place.
But wouldn't, under those circumstances, there be an actual error, an actual illegal sentence, which is what 973.13 is designed to correct? Whereas in this case, we don't have an actual factually illegal sentence. We have a factually legal sentence. There is no excess, to use the language of 973.13. As a matter of the truth of the case, it's just a failure of the record to reflect an explicit admission from the defendant's own lips of, I admit I am a repeater.
That would be sending, I think, the wrong message to the state in terms of how carefully it's going to address these proceedings if it can always sort of back out of them in that respect. I think, yes, we don't have a factually illegal sentence, but we have a legally illegal sentence. And we ought to put in place safeguards so that this doesn't happen. And we shouldn't rely on somebody discovering this. I mean, it's possible that somebody could be sentenced in excess of what's legal, and nobody would ever find that. So I would urge the court to adopt an approach which would prevent this from happening to somebody else.
Thank you, Mr. Andrewick.
Thank you.
You have 5 minutes to rebuttal. Mr. Posner-Weber, Assistant Attorney General representing the state of Wisconsin.
Good morning, Chief, members of the court. I'm sick as a dog. I apologize.
There are several on the bench. Join you.
A defendant who bargains for, asks for, and received enhanced sentences gives up his right to complain about the sufficiency of the proof regarding the prior felony convictions. State's principal position in this litigation. He bargained for them, he asked for them, he received them. Under those circumstances, he should not be heard to come into an appellate court and complain about getting what he asked for in
the
first place.
How do we know he bargained and asked for and received? I mean, where in the bargain and asking for and receiving does it say was a repeat offender? What he did was he bargained for a heavier penalty than would ordinarily be allowed, but does he know that or does his lawyer know that?
I'm inferring the knowledge and understanding to both his attorney and himself. There's no claim of ineffective assistance of counsel here. If he'd been ill-advised by his defense attorney, the first thing we would have expected to see is a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. A throwaway alternative argument was raised in the post-conviction motion, and it never went anywhere. It wasn't pressed in the circuit court, and it wasn't pressed in the Court of Appeals. If he'd been misadvised by his trial attorney, or if his trial attorney had never mentioned that this was a sentence that could only be achieved by enhancement, there'd have been a mockery here. There'd have been a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel pressed in the trial court. I think the only inference that we can draw from the absence of that is that counsel advised him. Counsel told him what he was getting into.
So then the state's position is that where the defendant bargains, asks for, and receives a penalty in excess of the penalty for the crime charged without the repeater, that you infer he knew about the repeater, was told about the repeater, understood about the repeater, pleads guilty to the repeater, and he'd be sentenced on the repeater.
On the facts of this case, yes, we're asking the court to infer that he knew that his sentence was being enhanced by virtue of the repeater allegation.
But the facts of this case are any time you bargain, ask for, receive more than the maximum. Well, tell me then why not. I know you're balking, but I want to know what other fact is there in this case.
Well, it's properly pleaded.
Okay.
It's properly pleaded. The repeater allegation was properly pleaded.
Okay.
In this case.
I'll go along with that. The state in the information, in the complaint, indictment, or information or amendment thereto before or at arraignment or before acceptance of plea has the repeater properly pleaded. When you say properly pleaded, that is, the elements are there. We don't know if they're true. Okay. I'll agree with
facially,
that.
Facially.
Right. Facially accurate. What else?
As was pointed out by Justice Bablich in the initial appearance, the transcript of the initial appearance, at record 5 in this case, full recitation of the allegations, affirmative.
But do you need that? Suppose that hadn't happened. Suppose that hadn't happened. Suppose they hadn't said, apparently, you're pleading guilty or that these are repeaters. Suppose you had nothing else other than a bare-bone record of a plea colloquy relating to this complaint.
We can take away the guilty plea waiver form, too.
I'm asking you.
And I'm satisfied on the strength of the guilty plea questionnaire and the plea colloquy, I'm satisfied that he understood precisely what was happening here. This arose again in the context of plea negotiations, absent a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel. I understand you're trying to identify the outer boundaries.
The minimum, yeah, because that's what you said your position was. Bargained, asked for, and received. So I'm asking you, is that going to be enough, or do you want these other things? Because I want to get... What you want to reduce here are the number of cases you get that are going to be variations on the theme, right?
Right.
Otherwise, we have to look at every single case. That's the whole point about, you know, having forms for the colloquy, having forms for the questionnaire. Figure if everybody fills out the same or a relatively same form, you may decide in a case that's okay.
As a matter of proper practice, the facts and circumstances of this case, I think we'd be comfortable saying this is a standard below which we would not want prosecutors or circuit courts to go. In this situation, we have a clear initial appearance where the defendant is telling everyone that he understands that he's subject to sentence enhancement. We've got a guilty plea questionnaire and waiver of rights form. We've got a satisfactory plea colloquy, but for a question pertaining directly to admission of the prior acts. And we have a defendant who's never sought to withdraw his plea. So if you're looking for a standard, I think factually this case establishes a benchline.
Well, that's what it said in Rockwell. That's the problem. Isn't it? It said this was the bare minimum. What happens is then that whenever we say it's a bare minimum, pardon me?
I said it's 513, that's exactly.
513, yeah. I'm sorry, I didn't assume this, that Justice Bradley is right. And what happens in all these cases is we say this is a bare minimum. No further go with we. And then the next case comes, and what was a bare minimum now becomes, from my perspective, the middle of the law. And we start back down, up or down. I mean, this is a repeat thing, not only in criminal cases, but civil cases, and it's an aspect of the law, which I recognize and we have to tolerate, but that's why I'm pressing you.
Understood. I read Rockwell for the proposition that, as Justice Wilcox pointed out, we're looking in the context of the entire record discussion. And I just don't...
What are we looking for?
Linkage that shows that this defendant knew that he was looking at possible sentencing as a repeater. And we have that from the initial appearance on down. Linkage that shows that the rest of the plea is constitutionally antiseptic. No claim that it isn't here. In the context of the entire record discussion, how could this be anything other than an affirmative admission? You could only get there by enhancing the sentences. And he's never called out his trial attorney's performance, and he's never said, I want to withdraw my pleas because I didn't know what was going on. How can it be anything but an affirmative admission?
Counsel, we're supposed to be part law developing and law clarifying. And I happen to have that same section of Rockwell in front of me because my concern is, what are we doing with this case? Mm-hmm. The language at 512 and 513 of Rockwell, first of all, you have, and I'll read part of it for you that's important. It states, we conclude that under the circumstances of this case, well, of course, you know, when you see under the circumstances of this case, you're supposed to say narrow, 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 fact specific. And then the paragraph goes on to finally end with this sentence. While the circumstances here approach the absolute bare minimum for a valid admission, they nevertheless are sufficient. I bet you dollars to donuts. I don't know what that means, but I bet that if you prevail in this case, the opinion is going to say someplace, under the circumstances of this case, and this is the bare minimum for a valid admission, or something similar to that. So what are we doing? I mean, where is the law development? Where are the principles? And if we're not going to do that, then let's get on to something else.
Two responses. First line of the state's analysis, obviously, is we'd like you to consider applying doctrines of waiver, judicial estoppel to this and say, under these circumstances, no defendant should be heard to complain about the sentences received. And we can talk about those arguments in a minute. What I would like to see the court do, and we talked about this at length in the preparation for this case, this court has authority to exercise its power of judicial administration under Article 7, Section 3. In the special materials for taking pleas, SM 32, you've got question number 29 in the current version of the special materials. SM 32, question 29, has the judge, in situations where a plea is being entered to a repeater allegation, has the judge ask, were you convicted? State's alleged X, did you do it? Were you convicted? The version of SM 32 that was in effect at the time of this case didn't have that question. We traced back the special materials and found that question number 29, showed up in the 1994 revisions of the special materials. This case was pleaded and sentenced in 93.
Did the judge follow the SM 32 other than that?
As near as I can tell, no other aspects of the plea colloquy have been brought into question by the defense. I don't have the special materials that were in use in 93. We just traced back to find the first time.
You don't know. Because you know very well that there are judges that don't follow SM 32, so it's
right.
Quite, I understand that. You made a good point. But you can write SM 32 on...
Well, this court in the past has exercised that power of judicial administration to say, circuit courts, you will do X. In State versus Recio, you told circuit courts that they had to advise a defendant that a court can't accept a less than unanimous verdict.
And what happens when the court doesn't do these things? Do we reverse the conviction or we say, do it again, we'll tell you a second time?
I think this court obviously has to hesitate before it reverses a conviction. Bear in mind, this is an old case. I mean, we're talking about a case from 93 here. District 2 has been writing regularly, every 6 months, telling district attorneys how to plead repeater allegations. There are fewer of those cases now than there were 3 years ago, pre-Zimmerman, pre-Coppin,
Goldsmith. Those are Court of Appeals cases.
All Court of Appeals cases. Court of Appeals has been telling prosecutors how to plead repeater allegations. There have been fewer of those cases. So what I'd like to see the court do is in its power of judicial administration, direct circuit courts not to accept a plea to an information containing a repeater allegation without asking question 29.
We already teach it that way at the Judicial College.
Right. But now you're here. You can. the Supreme Court has oversight and judicial administrative authority. It can say, when you take a plea to an information that contains a repeater allegation, ask question 29.
Counsel, but I'm not sure I believe you. And I say this rhetorically, I don't mean this. But I'm saying, you know, okay, the statute 973.12 says that it has to be admitted by the defendant or proved by the state. Okay, I mean, that's a legislative directive. And we really mean it, they say. And now you want us to employ our administrative powers to say, ask question 29, and we really mean it. Unless, I mean, there's an argument that unless there's some teeth to and we really mean it, then we're just swinging in the wind. So, why not put some teeth into it and some consequences? An argument, I don't know if this, but that's the argument. Because once we say, and we really mean it, question 29, and they don't, then we'll say, but under the circumstances of this case, this is the bare minimum when we're, you know what I'm saying?
Sure.
It's a waste of time.
Sure.
What should we do?
I understand you to be concerned about prosecutors not following direction, about circuit courts not following direction. I am not nervous about having this case supplant Rockwall as the, quote, bare minimum, close quote.
You think it has to? I mean, this is
because I'm much more willing to find an admission under Rockwall's general totality test, perhaps than the defense's. I think this case satisfies Rockwall and said as much in the brief.
But it's lower than Rockwell. I mean, it moves the bar a bit. Rockwell had this colloquy that this case doesn't have.
Rockwell had a colloquy that this case doesn't have. The bar will be moved a skosh lower.
A what?
Skosh. Well, I was going to talk about the defendant wanting egg in his beer, too, so I'm trying to use my analogy
spirit. You might be sick, but not that.
I'd like to talk about waiver and judicial estoppel and invited error.
Well, no, I'd like to stay with the questions raised at this point. Follow up Justice Bradley's question. It strikes me that this case is, the defendant is asking us for a bright line. There almost has to be a colloquy, and it has to be a literal admission or proof by the state. And he says that's what the statute says, and the statute means what it says. And that's what the statute does say. It doesn't say constructive admission. So why should we interpret it as constructive admission?
My gut reaction is because it would work an amazing unfairness if you did not, in circumstances like this one, where the record screams out that everyone in this case did what they did with their eyes open. Within the context of Rockwall, within the context of the record discussion, language from Rockwall at pages 505 and 506. In the context of the record discussion, there isn't another explanation. There just isn't. If there were, the defense would be arguing ineffective assistance, and the defense would be trying to pull its plea. And they're not doing that.
You think the legislature intended that the word admission be construed as being constructive admission, and if so, do you have any proof of that?
I don't know, and I have not looked at the draft.
What about a common sense, then, explanation for it? If I'm writing this case, and I don't want, I mean, I took this case
least arguably, I took this case to decide what needs to be done at these things and not whether or not he waived by judicial estoppel, as you are, I'm sure, well aware. So if I'm writing this case, how do I explain that the word admission means constructive admission, other than your most recent statement that this would be an injustice of the rule?
I haven't looked at the drafting file for the statute, so I don't know if the legislature, if there's anything in the legislative history that specifically speaks to this one way or the other. It seems clear to me that this court has interpreted Rockwall to allow for something less than a defendant standing up and saying, I did it, yes, I admit it. And certainly the preferred approach would be to have question 29 asked in every case involving a repeater allegation. I still think this court should do that. If the court wants, I will do research on the legislative history of the statute. It seems to me that this court has been willing to entertain the position that you can look at the totality and infer or find an admission, not an explicit admission, but an admission sufficient to satisfy the requirements of the statute.
What was the defendant's motion here?
Post-conviction motion? I don't have a copy in front of me. I thought it was brought for sentence modification, or in the alternative, a claim of deficient performance, ineffective assistance.
Okay. And your position is we should just deny this, right? And then when you take that position, you run into the issues that I and others, especially Justice Bradley, raised on the bench about what does this mean for other cases. It seems to me we ought to grant his motion and send this back, but not under 973.13 so that he automatically gets reduced down, but that you try out the facts of this case. He says he didn't, he doesn't say he didn't do it, he just says the record's not good enough. But, I mean, that's your point that you made in the beginning, that he should have done ineffective assistance of counsel. Well, he did that. That isn't tried for the moment. And that, or that he should have asked for a plea, opening the plea. So why don't we do that? Why don't we give him that?
For starters, he hasn't asked for that.
Pardon me?
For starters, he hasn't asked for that.
Well, he doesn't ask for opening the plea, but why does he have to ask for that?
Well, there's case law that says you can't remand for plea withdrawal in the absence of a request having been made in the circuit court. Are you talking about sending him back to status quo ante?
Yeah, well, about my conversation with Mr. Enderegg saying, let's give him another sentencing rather than plea, but why does it have to be under 973.13? Why does it have to be just an automatic limiting? What I am looking for is a technique that will get to the merits here. Did he or didn't he? Isn't he guilty of these other convictions instead of fooling around on a constructive admission? Look, error was made here.
Obviously.
The state made a mistake,
yeah.
Defendant didn't correct it, the circuit court didn't correct it, right? And then we're going to weave this fiction that's going to follow us through all of these other cases. Let's look for something that makes sense, that's pragmatic.
Well, if you're looking for a mechanism to remand this for status quo ante, to pre-plea, the state has to be given an opportunity at that point to prove up the repeater allegations.
I understand that. I'm trying to do that. Now, I understand that we can't get back to pulling his plea without his agreeing to that. That's your point, right? So I'm looking for a technique.
All these appellate courts keep asking me to make arguments for the other side. This has happened earlier this month in District 1. I don't have a mechanism at hand.
You do, it's for the state, because then the state can prove up these allegations, which I assume they can. right? Yeah. Can't you think they can too?
Yes.
Do you have any reason to think they can't?
No, I don't.
All right. So he doesn't know, and you think they can. So let's do it. That's all I'm trying to do. And I obviously was not smart enough to think of one myself.
Well, in the context of the Fourth Amendment, there's a case called State versus Washington. I think it's a Court of Appeals decision. It may be a Supreme Court decision, where the appellate court kept jurisdiction over the cause, but remanded it for further proceedings for the taking of evidence on a Fourth Amendment issue. I think it's like 124 was second, somewhere in there. State versus Washington. It was one of Dan Blinken's cases when he was in the Milwaukee DA's office. Presumably this court could keep jurisdiction over the cause and remand it for further fact-finding.
Well,
I think Mr. Anderegg might have something to say about that.
I know. That sounds to me that under what theory?
Well, doesn't Mr. Anderegg have a statutory due process objection if we do that? He says, then he makes the exact same argument he's making today. The statute says this, and I'm entitled to this.
Were I in his position, I'd make that argument. I'm not sure that it would be an argument that he could prevail on. And long before we got to that, I'd be asking you to accept my waiver and judicial estoppel and invited error arguments, all of which, unfortunately, have fallen by the wayside in this oral argument.
You've got 30 seconds.
Something like that. Can't do it in the interest of justice.
Can't we construe this post-conviction motion to be a opening of the plea? I mean, construing him is not saying anything to mean an admission.
You get to the point where you're really doing violence, though, to his pleading. Now, the defendant's post-conviction motion here was for sentence modification, or in the alternative, a claim of ineffective assistance. That dropped out. He's only asked for sentence modification. He doesn't want to pull his plea.
Right. And the bottom line is he doesn't want the record repaired either. What he wants is the benefit of the procedural irregularity that appears in this record. He wants to be rewarded for the fact that nobody made him say, I admit it.
He wants egg in his beer. Yes. Got it.
Tell us about waiver.
Thank you.
I'm sorry.
Oh, no.
Real quick. One of your answers was unsatisfactory to me, and that was, as I understood it, Justice Babbage was asking a question of, look, the statute seems pretty clear, admit or prove, and why don't we just go with that? And your response, as I understood it, was because it would be such an injustice, given the facts of this case. And what concerns me is, are you asking, I mean, that's part of the balancing that this court always does. I mean, if there is an error made, even in some horrendous fact situations where it's going to be a tremendous injustice to put a victim of a rape, child rape case again through a trial, we don't say, oh, we're going to change the rule of law because it's an injustice on the particular facts of this case. And that's what your response was. So I asked Justice Babbage's question again. Why should we read into it constructive admission?
That was part of my response to Justice Babbage. I also said that this court, certainly in the absence of any legislative history or legislative intent to the contrary, this court in Rockwall has seen fit to look to something other than a direct explicit admission to satisfy the statute. In Rockwall, you spoke of the context of the entire proceeding.
Okay, I can hear that. Waiver
argument. Any of three positions, judicial estoppel, waiver, or the doctrine of invited error. It seems to me that judicial estoppel and waiver are probably the two that I would settle on were I writing this particular case. When a party takes a position in court successfully, the party should not be permitted to change that position to suit self-interest, particularly when the opposing party is prejudiced by that change. And in this case, There was simply no dispute over what the parties wanted. There was no dispute that the court could go forward and sentence the man as a repeat offender. Now, to suit the moment, 6 years plus after sentencing, the defendant came forward and said, can't sentence me as a repeat offender. There was a failure of proof. What Mr. Leibnitz ignores is that the circuit court in this case did what Leibnitz asked him to do. The court will want to take a look at record 48, which is the plea colloquy, at page 19, when the circuit court says, the court, in imposing its sentence and certainly taking into account the recommendations of the prosecutor and also taking into account the fact that those recommendations have been joined in by the defendant and his counsel, the court did what he asked the court to do. The state bargained for it, the defendant bargained for it, the defendant got what he asked for.
But if he didn't understand, if he assumed that for purposes of my question, he did not understand, then isn't there a real injustice being perpetrated?
If
we decide this simply by saying he didn't raise it, sorry, here's the door.
If he did not understand, he should have been asking for permission to withdraw his pleas. He should have been objecting when the court imposed sentence. He should have been objecting when the court made its finding of fact that he was a repeater. None of that happened.
Your real point is that we should not give this because because the correct procedural technique to object when the state has not proved on the record and the defendant hasn't admitted on the record repeater offenses, and you've been sentenced as a repeater, that the procedural technique is not sentence modification, but withdrawal of a plea. Therefore, he made the wrong motion.
I'm not saying that a defendant can't raise this via a motion for sentence modification. What I was saying to Justice Bablich was, he was positing a hypothetical. What if this guy really didn't understand? And if he really didn't understand, he'd be talking with Mr. Andreig, and there'd be a post-conviction motion for plea withdrawal.
But why should you allow this as a sentence modification? Why should you allow the defense that the record is not good enough to show repeater? That's the defense here, right? Why shouldn't you say, if that's your defense, you should make the motion for plea withdrawal, not sentence modification?
Under the facts and circumstances of some cases, that might be an appropriate motion. Under Justice Bablich's hypothetical.
But in any case, in this case, as I've been listening to your argument, I think that's your argument, that this is not the right motion to raise the issue. As long as it was in the complaint, information, or indictment before the plea, and there's some ambiguity, I'm not holding it up enough.
I'd want to think about more of the ramifications of the procedural, the differences in the procedural mechanisms that you're suggesting here. I mean, I come back to the defense's bottom line because they're really the ones that set the groundwork here. They raise it not as a question of involuntary plea. Can I finish?
If you don't understand the plea, if you don't understand what you're pleading to, or there's been some other error, you move for a withdrawal, you'll get an opportunity to replead. You're not done, right?
If the plea wasn't knowing or voluntary or intelligent, sure.
Yeah.
Banger.
That's right. So why shouldn't that be done here?
Because he's never said he didn't understand.
I know. Whatever it is. Okay.
I have one follow-up question, if I could. Go your route of deciding this case based upon judicial estoppel or waiver, then your suggestion is, I think, that we can avoid lowering the Rockwell floor altogether and avoid deciding the question of whether the statute permits a constructive admission to be found based upon the record, right?
Sure. If you employ one of the equitable doctrines, you would not need to get to that issue.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel.
Mr. Andrewreck?
Thank you. I guess I'd like to first point out that the motion that was filed in the trial court.
Is the tape working? And his light? I see his lights are not working, so maybe the tape isn't working also. Oh.
Thank you. I guess I'd like to first point out that the motion which was filed with the circuit court was, I believe, entitled Motion to Void Excessive Sentence Not Authorized by Law, so that it wasn't a motion to modify a sentence in the sense that the defendant thought the sentence should be distinct, but it was a motion wherein the defendant was saying that the statute required the sentence to be changed. Also in that motion, there was an allegation relative to ineffective assistance of counsel, but that was sort of a conditional matter. And if the court would like to look at that particular motion, it will find that what the defendant was stating in that particular motion was that in the event that the circuit court ruled that he was somehow barred from bringing this motion because of previous actions of counsel would fail to identify this issue, a la the Escalona-Naranjo case, then and only then would he be positing an ineffective assistance of counsel claim. So I sort of want to diffuse the idea that he was alleging ineffective assistance of counsel and then chose not to pursue a trial counsel, because what he was really getting at would be post-conviction counsel.
So it was a way to get around the fact that he had not made this argument earlier on in his appellate proceedings?
Well, yeah, and as it turned out, it really wasn't necessary because he hadn't brought any sort of proceedings of any substantive nature, which it could be alleged he had to include this at. But I didn't know that at the time that I was drafting the motion, so I included that as sort of a prophylactic measure just in case somebody else had brought this up and had brought something on his behalf and not raised this issue.
Mr. Andrick, did you ask for a hearing when you filed your motion at which Mr. is it Finke? Waring Finke would testify?
We did not request a Mockner hearing at which Waring Finke would have testified.
So it wasn't just the court's decision not to have an evidentiary hearing. You didn't request one, is that right?
That's correct. We did not request a Mockner hearing. And I guess that fits to this issue, that the motion that we filed really wasn't an ineffective assistance of trial counsel allegation. It was only the possibility that maybe post-conviction counsel had missed this issue and had raised some other issue, thereby potentially barring him from raising this
issue. Could you help me with the facts? Was there a post-conviction motion, a complaint of some kind that...
We filed a post-conviction motion with the Washington County Circuit Court and went in and essentially made the same arguments that have been made to this court. And Judge Annette Ziegler denied our motion. And from that point, we took an appeal from her denial. Does that answer your question?
I mean, right after the original conviction plea bargain, was there any post-conviction motion then?
None that I'm aware of. I think that 6 years went by. I believe there's some documents in the court file wherein the defendant had been granted an extension to file a notice of intent to pursue post-conviction relief. But I don't believe that he had followed up on that and filed anything. So that
what I'm trying to get at is apparently neither the defendant nor the defendant's counsel at the initial proceedings has ever testified to what the defendant knew and what was discussed, and whether there was any misunderstanding at all. It's just sort of an abstraction here that the law requires
bing, bing, and it didn't happen.
That is correct, that there has been no hearing at which either the defendant or his attorney have testified as to what he knew or didn't know or thought or didn't think. We are proceeding on the grounds that the statute, and I'm not so sure that I would call it an abstraction, but the statute requires the result that we are seeking. With regard to the procedural bars that the state has set forth in terms of judicial estoppel and waiver, I think there's a fundamental problem with that. Because the state alleges repeat offender status in a case like this and seeks an enhanced penalty, it's its obligation and its burden, and this court stated in State v. Meyer, to make good in the charge and the essential particulars. And the bottom line is that if the prior conviction is an essential element of proof that the state has to establish if it wants to secure the additional punishment that it's seeking, and if it fails to do that, that's when Section 973.13 comes into play. And the language in that statute forcefully states that in any case penalty imposed exceeds that authorized by law, the excess is void. So if we bring in these doctrines and the court relies on those, that a sentence can stand because of some procedural bar, then that result will be in direct conflict with this statute. And I think that the statute needs to control in that circumstance. And we shouldn't embark upon a course where a defendant could be serving a multi-year prison sentence in excess of law simply because he didn't raise the issue earlier. I wanted to respond briefly to some matters that the state raised.
Very briefly, counsel, your time is up. So you got one long sentence. That's it.
One long sentence. Okay, I guess I would state that with regard to whether or not this should be sent back for the possibility for a defendant to withdraw his plea, I would pose the question as why a defendant should have to go back and be sentenced again, possibly be exposed to a longer sentence than he received by a different judge, different prosecutor, different defense attorney, simply because the state failed to discharge its obligation to prove his prior status.
Isn't there a case law that prohibits this?
I think there may be.
Can't increase the sentence on a resentencing.
Sir, I can't hear either one of you.
But there's case law that prohibits that. You can't increase the sentence upon a resentencing except if there have been intervening circumstances that profoundly authorize it.
Okay, counsel, thank you. Thank you, Assistant Attorney General Cody Weber. That ends the hearing on 98-2182.